What was your role in that process?
Well, my role at the beginning was as a detail design draftsman, and then of course the company was expanding at an enormous rate. As I said, when I came in 43, it had like a dozen employees, and by the end of the war it had approaching 1,000. Mm. And so I was in charge of the engineering, and in charge of the engineering department, and then we were building these units for all of the Allied governments, for the British, the Russians, the Belgians, etc. And when the war ended, why, immediately those contracts were all canceled. And that was a stunning blow to the company, which hadn't really made any profit during the war, because the excess profit taxes and the renegotiations of the contracts and the facilities we owned, and even the working capital, was provided by the government. So the company didn't prosper financially by the war, and that was proper, you know. But the company did get a lot of technical know-how. And then but it was a stunning blow. The company survival was really questionable. I went with another group for 2 or 3 years. We had a company that had made the engines for the plants we were building during the war, Continental Aviation, which doesn't exist anymore, it's part of Teledyne now, had contracts to bring over from Germany all kinds of equipment, including oxygen equipment and engines and compressors and the buzz bombs and so forth, and experiment with those German devices and write reports on technical characteristics, which could be then available to American business and American military. So I did that for 2 or 3 years. In the meantime, the company didn't want to stay in Chattanooga. Tennessee was a depressed part of the country in those days. It shows how much Detroit was prosperous and Tennessee was impoverished, the reverse of now. But it appeared that the principal market for the original concept of producing oxygen to sell on site to large users was in the steel industry. So we found this place in Pennsylvania, and a used factory drew us to the particular site, and came there, and then began the recovery from the war. And then I came there in 1950, after being off on this other thing for 2 or 3 years, and was there ever since.
You said that the company had 1,000 employees at the end of the war. What happened to the workforce at that point when everything was cut back?
It was just all disbanded. And there were, I think, again, the company was back to around 20 people.
Hmm. So by the time you got to Pennsylvania, that was your workforce.
Yeah, right. And we were, in those early days in Pennsylvania, really a manufacturing company producing this equipment. And we didn't realize it when we came there, but this used factory we found was in Emmaus, in the heart of the so-called Pennsylvania Dutch country. And that was a very lucky, fortunate thing, because the Pennsylvania Dutch people are basically, I mean, they're the kind of people who believe in a day's work for a day's pay. And we had really, in that little small business starting up increment by increment, we had very reliable, conscientious workers available, factory workers.
What kind of interactions did you have with Leonard Poole in those very early days?
Well, it was very close interaction every hour, every day, and over the years, he was He was, I think, about 16 years older than I, and he didn't have any children. He was my mentor, and he treated me in some ways like a son. I resisted that. I didn't want to be his son, but it was a very close working relationship in all the years that we were together until the time he died.
What was his management style like, specifically in that early time period when the company was just getting started?
Well, his management style was was very appropriate for a company of that size. He supervised everything. He had his finger in everything. Mm-hmm. And he worked hard and continuously, and nothing escaped him. Now, eventually it came to the point when the company, when that sort of hands-on, personal, hour-by-hour management couldn't cope with the size of the company, and he recognized that. It was in those transitions that he began really to assign more responsibility to me, and I didn't know anything about management. I didn't have any management experience either, but I think temperamentally I was more disposed to think about the organizational structure and assume and transferring responsibility to others and so forth than Leonard was.
I was going to ask.
And he wanted me to go off, and I did go off to the Harvard Business School for that 14 mm-hmm. weeks or whatever it is, where it was his hope that I would learn management skills, and I suppose I did learn some, but I think what I learned mostly on the job.
So it was his doing that you went to Harvard for mm-hmm. that program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was going to ask again in those early days whether how much responsibility you had, or did you have to check with Poole in making important decisions?
Yeah, well, in the early days, everybody had to check everything with Leonard Poole. But as time went on, he weighed people, and he came to really repose more responsibility in me than in most of the others. But I was always very sensitive about that, even until the time he died. I talked over with him important issues before establishing him as company policy. And years now, I'm jumping ahead, but years later, his wife, Dorothy, got cancer and had a long suffering period, died in the New York Sloan Kettering Hospital. And during the end of her illness for several months, he had an apartment in New York and stayed there with her. He was very devoted to her and didn't want to leave her alone. And I was in de facto running the company then. But I made a point of going and sitting down and talking over things with him frequently.
Wasn't there a period when his brother might have been the heir apparent?
Leonard and George's background was this. Their father had been a welder on a railroad, and they lived in Minneapolis. And their father died when they were very young. I think Leonard was 16. And the mother was left in an impoverished condition with, I believe, three boys and a sister, I think. I know there's a sister, four children, the oldest of whom was Leonard, who was 16. And he really assumed the role of the father and the breadwinner. And he got various kinds of jobs and supported them. And the next younger brother was George. Leonard eventually then ended up in Detroit working for one of the industrial gas companies. And then he got George, who was 7 or 8 years younger than he, a job in the same company. And they were both salesmen. And there, Leonard developed the idea that rather than producing this gas and then hauling it to where it's going to be used to make it at the site, and George stayed, and he left and started Air Products and borrowed money from his wife's father and from everybody he could, and as I say, was almost bankrupt until the military came along. And then he encountered, this is an important thing not to forget, he encountered Carl Anderson, who just died 6 months ago, born in 1898, and just died. But Andy, could I divert, because he's an important part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Andy was a, Andy's predecessor was a man, L.S. Toomey. L.S. Toomey was a graduate of Purdue University in probably 1900 or something like that. And when Toomey and Anderson used to tell me these stories when I was young, when Thomas Edison started the Edison Electric Lamp Company in Cleveland after they did the development work in New Jersey, and they discovered, as everybody now knows, that if you put a tungsten filament in an argon atmosphere, you could make the incandescent lamp. And the source of argon was from the old German Linde company in Munich. And I've forgotten what Toomey told me they had to pay for a cylinder of argon. I think it was $100. Mm. Mr. Edison hired young engineers, and he hired Toomey, and he said, your job is to design a unit to separate air and get argon so we can make our own. And Toomey didn't know anything about that, but he struggled along and had a couple engineers, and after a few years, they had a unit that extracted argon. And Mr. Edison had his argon, and then Toomey encountered another entrepreneurial guy who had the idea of using the know-how that they had developed to make oxygen. That's what the big industrial market was. So they formed a company called Gas Industries Company. It was located in Pittsburgh. And during from the time of World War I through the 20s, they produced industrial gas plants, which they sold to various small entrepreneurs in cities all over the country to extract oxygen and pump it into cylinders and sell it to welding shops, things like that. And in 1920, when Anderson got his engineering degree at Purdue, Toomey got him to come into the Gas Industries Company. And he worked there all these years. Then the Depression came. There were nobody buying any oxygen plants at all. The company went really out of business. Didn't go in bankruptcy, but it just simply went out of business. Andy had all of those engineering drawing, all that experience. And when he and Leonard Poole met each other in 1941 or something like that, that was the key to Poole making this idea work, because Anderson knew how to do it. And so that's how Anderson came into the picture. And then to come back to your early point, then George came into the company about 1943, and there was, of course, a real brotherly affinity between George and Leonard. When the first public stock was sold in 1946, Reynolds and Company was the securities firm that sold the stock, and they really had financial control of the company. They had three directors and they controlled it. And they had confidence in Leonard, but they didn't have confidence in George. And so Leonard had a big battle with those people. Eventually they left the board, and then from then on he had de facto control of the company. And he aspired, and many people thought that his success, that George should be his successor. And but the company was growing ever more technological. The engineering was getting more sophisticated and complicated, and I was more or less looked upon as the engineering member of the team. Anderson was a great engineer, set high. He was a great engineer in the old sense of a mechanical person who Andy always expected the management to decide what the engineers needed to do, and then if they decide what they want, we'll engineer it. Whereas I had a for no reason, I guess just my personality, was kind of the management and the engineer in the same person. And as it became more complex from a technical standpoint, why, gradually Leonard, and in the meantime he had other outside directors on the board, moved toward me taking more and more responsibility, and that eventually led to becoming first the chief operating officer and then the chief executive officer.
One of the things that I'm not quite clear on, and that in those early days it may have not had any real significant meaning, but what positions, if we could call it that, that you started out in design work.
Yeah.
And then, let's say, up till 1950, what different kinds of positions did you
have? Well, I was called engineer, and I was called engineering manager at one time. I was then in the 50s, I began to take a more active role in sales, and we had, by that time, three or four salesmen. And I said, I don't want to have the title salesman. I want to be sales engineer, because I can put a different... Mm-hmm. So I had the title sales engineer. And then I had the title, vice president of sales. And in 1959, I was made, given the title vice president and general manager, which was sort of like the chief operating officer.
Okay.
And then subsequently, I was executive vice president for a time, and then I was president. And when I was president, we didn't use the terms in, like it's used now, chief executive officer and chief operating officer, but during those years, in using modern terminology, Leonard was the chief executive officer and I was the chief operating officer.
Okay. A few things that I've taken from the Out of Thin Air book might be interesting to comment on, and I'm going back now to 1952, which is, I guess, now you're a sales engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the military aspects. You're advocating that the military aspects should be turned into commercial. It could be a commercial advantage.
Yeah. Well, what happened in the development of the industrial gas industry, the on-site took a certain small market sector to supply large users, but all the rest of the vast industry was supplied by extracting oxygen, compressing it, putting in cylinders, and delivering it to customers. And that's very expensive because the cylinder weighs 15 times as much as the oxygen. And during the 20s or 30s, the one company, the Linde Division of Union Carbide, had developed the technology for producing liquid oxygen. And for the vast array of middle-sized customers, that was the most efficient way to serve them. But nobody had the cryogenic technology to know how to do that. And then in the we had we had learned somewhat from the German experience during World War II, because they were producing liquid oxygen for their rockets, and we had the benefit of that background, and it wasn't very helpful. The Germans didn't, surprisingly enough, didn't keep very good records. But we had the benefit of that background. And then, with the Cold War going on, it was decided that in the U.S. military that we would use liquid oxygen and hydrocarbon fuel for the ballistic missiles. And so that we were drawn back to the Defense Department. And that whereas before, during the war, we were going to produce 1 ton a day of oxygen, now they were talking 10, 100, 1,000, several thousand tons. And so we started bidding on telling the government, Air Force by this time, that what were their choices. They could buy liquid oxygen from the only American company that produced it was Linde. And Linde said, we'll supply all you need anywhere in the world, and just tell us what you want. And we couldn't compete with that because we didn't have any production capacity. Linde had the benefit during World War II of, you remember, Roosevelt had introduced rapid depreciation for government contractors during the war, so they were able to put in large amounts of capital and write it down and have written down capital at the end of the war. And Carbide was fabulously wealthy then because they had a monopoly in this product and they had low capital cost. And so we just sat down and designed liquid producing plants that we thought would work, but we never had built any, and made presentations in the government showing that if it was during the Eisenhower administration and Wilson of General Motors was Secretary of Defense. I remember one day being in his big office in the Pentagon with 100 officers around there and making a flip chart presentation. Boy, I was shaking all over. Showing that if they would put in the capital, that we could produce oxygen for liquid for the Air Force at a price that would get the cap, compared to the Linde price, get the government capital back in less than a year. And so they made contracts with us to do that. And then we started building those liquid plants. They were primitive and energy inefficient by today's standards, but they were the best we could do. And we built on the West Coast and the Middle West at Cape Canaveral over here, the Kennedy Space Center, and elsewhere, these plants with government capital, and then we had operating contracts to operate them. Well, we were producing liquid oxygen on a scale that approached Union Carbide. And we said, oh boy, let's go on the commercial side. Well, there were some, and here's where George made an enormous contribution. There were some 60 of these small entrepreneurial industrial gas companies in Pittsburgh, and Cleveland, and Denver, and every principal city in the country, many of whom were using these old-fashioned gas plants that Anderson and the Gas Industries Company had made for them in the 1920s. And the cost of producing a 100 cubic feet was a standard unit of measurement of oxygen from those plants was around 25 cents. We were producing it in these government liquid plants for a nickel. So George set out, and we didn't have any money, and he didn't have much money, but he gave a little piece of cash and Air Products stock and acquired about 19 of these companies who had trucks and salesmen and so forth. And then we put in a new liquid producing plant based on the government know-how, and that made the company just go through a very high rate of growth and produce cash flow that permitted us to do other things.
How you had no financial background as such at this point yet.
No.
And here you are in the Pentagon testifying before, presenting a case to Wilson. And
yeah.
How did you feel? You said you were nervous about it, but how did you develop this ability to deal with the financial side?
Leonard had an intuitive feeling for the overall structure of a business, and I think that growing up in my teens on a farm helped me with that. Now, mind you, the farm was very impoverished, but a farmer had to do everything. He had to produce, he had to maintain quality control, he had to sell, mm-hmm. he had to have the financing if he could buy a new tractor. And when I was in those days in Michigan, boys who lived on farms were allowed to get a driver's license when they were 14 years old. And so we had a few chickens on the farm. And I started gathering those eggs and taking them to the city. It was 40-odd miles to Detroit, and going door-to-door selling these eggs. Well,